Good morning. I'm Brian. It's a pleasure to be here with you all this morning. As we begin to reflect on this gospel, let's pray. God, in the middle of all that we're holding together, would you meet with us and would you comfort our hearts with good news? Amen. So we are in our second week of Lent today, and as Susan pointed out, this very day coincides with the two-year anniversary of the beginning of the pandemic, and so we're taking time over this Lenten season to acknowledge all that we've been holding for 2 years now, for two long years, and we're taking these things and we're pouring them out intentionally before God. We're inviting God into this journey of all that we've been holding for the last 2 years, inviting him into the middle of these things, knowing that God truly cares about all that we've been holding. And so this morning, we're talking about pouring out our expectations before God. There have been many thwarted expectations over the last few years. Certainly expectations for plans that were immediately canceled. Emily and I had a Mediterranean cruise planned for April of 2020. We deferred it to April of 2021. It was canceled both times. We still haven't gone. That's fine. I'm not upset about it. Expectations, though, also for ourselves, for other people, for the communities that we're a part of, for ourselves, maybe we thought that we'd be further along in our careers or in our fitness, or we'd figured out some relational issue by now that's still hanging us up. Certainly a lot of disappointment around many of the communities we've been a part of. Maybe we've been disappointed, let down by the people around us, by family, or friends, people that we wouldn't have thought would have been so callous, people that we wouldn't have thought would have bought so easily into conspiracy theories. Expectations for our country, for the world, maybe have been thwarted. Maybe you're a crazy optimist like me and you thought that like a global pandemic would be the thing that would make politicians think we really did need Medicare for all. Or like that whole summer of nationwide protesting for racial justice in 2020, you thought maybe you had the expectation that it would result in some sort of meaningful reform. All these thwarted expectations over the last few years have left many of us in a state of constant disappointment. Like we've almost been trained to just expect the worst. Anything less than that will just leave us with dashed expectations. But the thing is, Christianity is a religion of hope. Christians, we're supposed to believe in a God who acts in history, who's on the move. We can't just be people who refuse to have any expectations at all. But what does it mean to be a people who still hope in God in the middle of just crushing disappointment after crushing disappointment? The psychologist David Brandt studied disappointment for 20 years. He said, disappointment is essentially unmet expectation. But we can't just not expect anything, he says. The psychologist says that's no way to live. You can't just refuse expectation because we're hoping creatures. We're gifted with imagination, with the ability to dream. But one thing he says we can do is we can evaluate our expectations and see if they match reality. Brandt goes on to say that disappointment can actually have its benefits in that it forces us to acknowledge and reevaluate our expectations, which is a process that encourages maturity. Many of my disappointments have woken me up to the fact that some of my expectations were actually misplaced. Back in 2015, 7 years ago now, I was a political conservative. And I remember the way that I was so disappointed with how this conservative movement lined up behind Trump. It actually caused me to rethink a lot of my expectations for this supposed party of Christian morality. And ultimately, it caused me to rethink my place and even the evangelical church I was a part of and what I expected out of that community. Moments of revelation, moments of clarity, while they can maybe be disappointing when they shatter our dreams or upset our expectations, they can actually be liberating if they help us align ourselves with what is more true or more worthy of our deepest expectations. The transfiguration of Jesus Christ is a moment of revelation. It's an uncovering of the glory of Jesus, which was shrouded in human frailty. But this moment of revelation is also an answer to the unmet expectations of his disciples. We know this, there's a clue here at the very beginning of this story. The very first few words of the text that was read say, now about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took his disciples to a mountain. So Luke reminds us of what Jesus has just said in the preceding verses, almost as if when Jesus shows him this moment of revelation, it's an answer to what they were just talking about. So what were these sayings? Just a few verses before this, the disciples are having a conversation about Jesus's identity. Jesus asks them, "Who do you think that I am?" And they give a whole bunch of terrible answers. They say, "Maybe you're Elijah. Maybe you're an ancient prophet risen from the dead. Maybe you're John the Baptist." That makes absolutely no sense. John the Baptist died like a week before that. I don't even understand what they meant. But Peter, who's always reliable to say something at least interesting, if not totally accurate, actually has a decent answer. He kind of gets it. He says, "You are the Messiah of God." The Messiah, this is God's chosen king for God's chosen people. This seems like the right answer. And so Jesus's reply to Peter is very interesting. Peter does not get the gold star that he was hoping for. He actually gets a stern command to keep his mouth shut. This is not the first or last time this happens to Peter. Why is this? Now, it's not that Peter is wrong necessarily, but Jesus seems to sense that Peter's expectations are skewed. Peter likely has a vision for the Messiah, the King of Israel, that is about victory and conquering. He's probably imagining a glorious warrior who's violently dealing retribution on the enemies of Israel, you know, who's exalting their nation at the expense of enemy nations, putting those nations to shame. And so Jesus, he reorients Peter's expectations. He tells him to be quiet, and then he says, "No, the Son of Man must undergo great suffering." And notice he doesn't refer to himself with that exalted title of Messiah, but with this much more humble title, the Son of Man. And he says, "And to be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised." And so there will be glory, this exaltation of being raised, but it doesn't come by victoriously and violently crushing enemies. It comes through great suffering, rejection, and being killed. And then Jesus says, this isn't just what's in it for me. He invites them to join him. He says to them all, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me." I'm not going to have time to fully unpack that statement, which really could be the source of just daily meditation for the rest of our lives. But one thing that Jesus is surely doing for Peter is reorienting his expectations for what it means that Jesus is the king, and the glory that Jesus will receive looks different than the kind of glory that Peter was searching for. Peter was expecting Jesus to take a crown and probably hoping that he might be able to get in on some of that also. And Jesus tells him that he's going to a cross. And he says, "Hey, Peter, you can get in on this also." This is the Lenten journey with Jesus. It's a journey to a cross. And this is not a spiritual metaphor, by the way, that we quote this verse in maybe some cutesy ways or see it on coffee mugs in Christian bookstores. Jesus was nailed to a real cross, and Peter would be nailed to a real cross. Jesus seems to be saying, "Join me in opposing the oppressive forces of this world, living out God's justice and peace and love and reconciliation to the point of being willing to suffer, and that is where true glory is found." Now, I just want to quickly say that this concept of carrying a cross has been misused, for example, in telling victims of abuse or oppression that they just need to carry their cross, accept the suffering, submit to it. But listen, Jesus did not suffer because he was silent in the face of injustice and oppression, but because he radically confronted it. But Jesus is telling them that this confrontation will not always result in the kind of glory that we would hope for. So what does this have to do with the transfiguration? So Jesus says these things to them, and it seems that they were probably struggling with it. I would say maybe especially Peter. It's not what they expected out of who they hoped was the Messiah. And even though this transfiguration moment happens a few days later, Luke intentionally connects this moment to these sayings of Jesus. And so in the middle of the disciples' confusion and disappointment, Jesus injects a moment of revelation and glory. Jesus has just described a vision for glory that doesn't quite fit with their expectations. And so God shows them Jesus's glory, putting hope in the middle of their disappointment. Jesus's face has changed. Matthew says it shone like the sun. Now, we don't know much about what Jesus's face was like. The lack of a description makes it seem like it was probably pretty nondescript. The name Jesus was just an ordinary Joe sort of name, indicating that Jesus was just a regular guy. And even though Peter thought, maybe this guy's the king, Jesus had just sort of squashed that hope a little bit and said, no, Peter, I'm going to be killed shamefully on a cross. But in this moment, they see Jesus in all of his dazzling reality. If last week's passage that Melissa spoke about emphasized Jesus's earthly body, his human pain, his hunger and his thirst, this text seems to be emphasizing Jesus's glory and his divinity. This glowing man seems very unlike us in some ways, right? And that's part of the point. But at the same time, we need to remember that it was precisely because of Jesus's weakness and humanness and normalness that this revelation was so surprising to the disciples and so necessary. They didn't expect this revelation of Jesus because Jesus's glory was hidden in human frailty. And as I thought about the expectations that we carry this week, I thought about what shapes our expectations of people. This passage made me think about how easy it is to make assumptions about people and how much is going on under the surface with people that we don't see. And God in this moment unveils what was really going on with Jesus. And it made me think, what if someone's reality was fully disclosed to us? Their past, their experiences, their inner world, the battles that they're facing, their hopes and their dreams. How might that defy the expectations that we put on other people? We might have overly low expectations for some people, or maybe overly high expectations for others. And these expectations are often based on appearances, which can be deceiving. Like maybe you didn't expect the guy with the mullet and the hand tattoo to be preaching to you this morning. It's probably a pretty valid expectation on a normal Sunday. But Jesus was actually constantly reorienting his disciples' expectations for people. One of the things Jesus was constantly doing in his teaching was telling his disciples that the people that you think are on the bottom are really on the top in God's estimation, and the people that we're tempted to think are on the top might actually be on the bottom in the way that God sees the world, right? It's the blessed are the poor and the hungry, those who thirst, those who mourn. Woe to those who are rich, who are full now. This passage reminds me that our eyes often deceive us and that God's view of reality is different from ours, and that it would be good for us to reevaluate our expectations of people and what people are worth around God's view of reality. Now, obviously, Christians believe that Jesus was unique in his divinity and a revelation of his glory is different. And yet every person is unique in the stamp of divine creativity on every human life made in the image of God. But in this particular moment, the disciples see Jesus revealed in his glory, and Moses and Elijah show up as well. And it says they talk to Jesus about his departure that Jesus was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, this, on the one hand, obviously means his death that he is headed to Jerusalem to accomplish. But there's actually a little bit more going on here. The Greek word for departure is the same word used for the Exodus. And so where are my Bible nerds at? Bible nerds up in here? So here, yeah, okay, media. Okay, so here we've got Jesus talking to Moses on a mountain about the Exodus, okay? These are words and images that are symbolic of the Exodus of the people of Israel out of Egyptian slavery. Moses, the great liberator of Israel, received a great revelation from God on a mountain once before, similar to what's happening here. And so Luke, with his narrative, is indicating to us this is a new Exodus. And here we have Jesus as the great liberator, and his journey into Jerusalem, into death, is not a defeat, it's an exodus. It's a journey into death, but through death into liberation. And the culmination of this is his resurrection. So this transfiguration is really a first glimpse for the disciples into Jesus's glory and reality, but it won't be the last glimpse. They will see Jesus in all of his resurrected glory as an ultimate vindication of the way that Jesus says to live. See, the resurrection tells us that even if living for God's justice and peace and sacrificial love might get you nailed to a cross, that won't be the end of the story. The resurrection is a good thing to fix and orient our expectations. The world will have many disappointments for all of us, but as we bring our expectations and our disappointment to God, God is often kind to us in reminding us of God's reality. God met the disciples in the middle of their confusion and dashed expectations with a glimpse of glory and hope. God literally speaks from a cloud and says, "This is my son, my chosen." So yes, even though he says he's going to be killed, he is the one. He is the chosen one. Listen to him, God says. Even if what he says sounds crazy, listen to him. When Jesus says that the first will be last and the last will be first, when he's inviting the sinners and prostitutes to come to him, I know this isn't how the world acts. I know that people are going to reject him, but listen to him. His way of living might lead into death, but it also leads into resurrection. So God speaks to disappointed disciples and reorients them with a reminder of Jesus's glorious reality. And one of my prayers for this morning, as we consider our own expectations and disappointments, is that God would meet us with a reminder of hope. Many of us could use it because we have all endured disappointments over the last few years. My disappointment with a church community that I was a part of and that I labored with for over 10 years caused me to walk away from friendships, from mentors. All of us have stories of dashed expectations, but the answer to that can't just be to lower our expectations of what God might do, to just assume the worst, to become a doom and gloom people. As we pour our expectations and disappointments to God today, let's also ask God to remind our hearts of the hope that we have, that he's not silent, that in the middle of our losses and disappointments and thwarted expectations, God is still making all things new. One of the ways that we remain a people of hope in a world of disappointment is that we ourselves, as the people of God, embody God's hope in our actions in this world. But having our hope set on God doesn't make us passive people in this world. It makes us a people of hopeful action. Jürgen Moltmann, he was called the theologian of hope. He says this: those who hope in Christ can no longer put up with reality as it is, but begin to suffer under it, to contradict it. The goad of the promised future stabs inexorably into the flesh of every unfulfilled present. I feel that. We have encountered many unfulfilled present moments. Moments, in other words, that look nothing like the hope that we claim to have in a God who acts. It's like, where is he at all? The contradiction between our hope and our dashed expectations, it goads us, it stabs at us. It's something that we suffer under. The material inequalities in this world stab at us. The racial injustice stabs at us. The needless COVID deaths stab at us. The anti-trans and anti-LGBT laws that are being passed in this country right now, they stab at us, because the expectation that we have in God's coming kingdom, it remains unfulfilled. And so one of the things that these disappointments do is it stirs us to action. Having hope in God doesn't make us blissfully unattached people in this world, just waiting for our chariots to come and sweep us to heaven. When our expectations are fixed on the hope that we have in God's kingdom of peace and justice, it makes us people who live under the weight of how this world lets us down so often, but we go to work. We labor under the weight of this groaning world, pushing towards the hope that we have in God. When we're disappointed with how the world is, we become those who struggle for what the world can be. We have a hope that God's peace will break in, God's justice will be established. But in this space, we are still in that unfulfilled present, and we will encounter disappointments. And it's good to simply know that God cares about those disappointments. And so we're going to take a moment now to pour out our expectations to God and our disappointments to God. We're going to embody this practice. There are little papers on your seats, and we're going to take a moment to write some of the thwarted expectations of these past 2 years, some of the disappointments that you may have encountered. And the act of writing them down, and these are special little papers, they dissolve when you put them in water. We're going to come up and we're going to place them in this basin where they will dissolve. And that dissolving doesn't mean that that disappointment is going to magically disappear, but it can be symbolic that what you are holding is also being held by God. I found this process to be very meaningful last week when we did this with some of the ways that we've lost control. And so we're going to just take a few moments right now to ask yourself what expectations for yourself, for your community, for your world have been thwarted these last 2 years. And then we're going to pour these expectations out before God. And so whenever you're ready, you can come and place that piece of paper into the basin.